Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Antiarrhythmics for Atrial Fibrillation, Practical Implications of the Latest Clinical Developments, which is certified by Medscape and presented by A. John Kam, MD, Stuart J. Connolly, MD, and Jean-Yves F. Louise, MD. Dr. Kam is a professor of clinical cardiology, St. George's University of London, consultant cardiologist, cardiothoracic department, St. George's Hospital, London, United Kingdom. Dr. Kam has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Actelion Pharmaceuticals, Eryx Therapeutics, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Cardiome Pharma, CV Therapeutics, Daiichi Sankyo, Menarini Group, Merck & Company, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Sanofi Aventis, Servier, and Zention. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Cardiome Pharma, Daiichi Sankyo, Menarini Group, Pfizer, and Sanofi Aventis. He received grants for clinical research from Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Daiichi Sankyo, Sanofi Aventis, and Servier. He served as a member of the Data Safety Monitoring Board for Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and Servier. He served as an expert witness for Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, Sanofi Aventis, and Servier. Dr. Kam does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Kam does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Connolly is a professor of medicine, director of cardiology, McMaster University, Hamilton General Hospital, McMaster Clinic, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Dr. Connolly has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Merck & Company, Portola Pharmaceuticals, and Sanofi Aventis. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Merck & Company, Portola Pharmaceuticals, and Sanofi Aventis. He received grants for clinical research from Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Merck & Company, Portola Pharmaceuticals, and Sanofi Aventis. Dr. Connolly does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Connolly does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Loese is a professor of cardiology, head arrhythmia department, Hôpital Européen Georges Pompidou, Paris, France. Dr. Loese has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Daiichi Sankyo, Medtronic, Merck Sharp & Dohme, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, Pfizer, Pierre Fabre, Sanofi Aventis, and Servier. He received grants for clinical research from Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Daiichi Sankyo, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck Sharp & Dohme, Sanofi Aventis, and Servier. Dr. Loese does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Loese does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to apply recent findings from clinical trials to clinical practice by updating and acknowledging changes to guideline recommendations for the management of atrial fibrillation. This activity is supported by Sanofi. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm John Camp from St George's Hospital in London. I'm your moderator today for this session entitled Antiarrhythmics for Atrial Fibrillation, Practical Implication of Latest Clinical Trial Developments. I'm joined by Stuart Connolly from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and Jean-Yves Leouzi from Hôpital Européen Georges Pompidou in Paris. Well, gentlemen, we're here at the American Heart Association meeting in Orlando, and we finally heard details of the PALLAS study. Of course, we already knew some of the details since the study was stopped early, and we learned of the unfavorable trend of data, which in Europe has already led to a relabeling and new warnings for patients with permanent atrial fibrillation. So let's start with reviewing the findings from PALLAS and then discuss what these findings mean for our patients with atrial fibrillation. Not only those with permanent atrial fibrillation, but those who may have paroxysmal or persistent atrial fibrillation and are currently doing well on their antiarrhythmic therapy. Stuart, tell us something of the PALLAS study results.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I'll just start off by talking a little bit about why the PALLAS study was done. It was largely based on the very positive results that we had in Athena, which was a study of dronedarone in patients with paroxysmal or persistent atrial fibrillation. And in that study, we saw a very significant reduction in cardiovascular hospitalization. We also saw reductions in cardiovascular death, reductions in stroke, reductions in arrhythmic death. We also observed in that study that some patients developed permanent atrial fibrillation, and the results seemed to be consistent in those patients as well. We also know that dronedarone has some potential beneficial physiologic effects that could be very helpful in permanent atrial fibrillation. It slows the heart rate quite a lot. It lowers blood pressure a little bit. It has antiventricular arrhythmic effects. And it also has some anti-adrenergic effects. And so we hypothesized that the beneficial effects we saw in the Athena trial would also carry over into the permanent atrial fibrillation population. And so we did a large randomized clinical trial of dronedarone versus placebo, double-blind trial, in patients with permanent atrial fibrillation. But one difference from the Athena study, in addition to permanent atrial fibrillation, we looked for patients with quite a high burden of vascular disease, certainly quite a bit higher than in Athena. Most patients had had some sort of major vascular event, such as MI, stroke, heart failure. The trial was going to randomize 11,000 patients almost, and follow these patients up for a mean of approximately 2 years. The two co-primary outcomes were first stroke, MI, systemic embolism, or cardiovascular death, and we had a second co-primary outcome of unplanned cardiovascular hospitalization or death. The main result of PALLAS was that there was a significant increase in both co-primary outcomes that I've just mentioned. And there was about a doubling of the outcome of stroke, systemic embolism, myocardial infarction, or cardiovascular death, with 43 events on dronedarone and 19 on placebo, and this was highly statistically significant. There was also a significant increase in unplanned cardiovascular hospitalization or death, with 127 events on dronedarone and 67 on placebo, and that was also highly statistically significant. When we look at the details of which events actually went up, we see that there was a significant increase in death, about a doubling. The p-value is borderline at 0.049. And if we dig into the deaths, we see that they're mostly cardiovascular, and most of the excess comes from an increase in arrhythmic deaths, which were quite a lot more common on dronedarone than on placebo. There was also an increase in stroke, 23 events on dronedarone compared to 10 on placebo, and that was a statistically significant increase. One of the non-primary outcomes was heart failure hospitalization, and we see an increase in heart failure hospitalization as well. about 80% increase, statistically significant.
Well, that must have been a big surprise to you, Stuart, because your whole hypothesis was just the reverse, that all of these would be reduced in permanent atrial fibrillation. So do you have any kind of explanation for why it happened?
Yeah, well, first of all, you're right. It was a pretty surprising, I would say, almost shocking turn of events. We really did anticipate that the beneficial effects seen in intermittent atrial fibrillation would carry over to permanent. I think that me for sure, and I think many of us who think about atrial fibrillation tend to think of it as a continuum from very short episodes to longer persistent episodes, eventually becoming permanent. And as such, we tend to think of it as being the same disease. Patients getting a bit older, getting a bit more vascular disease, but not fundamentally a different disease. And so there made no sense for the effects not to carry over. Or at least maybe they'd be a little less, but for it to be completely reversed, and it's really a dramatic reversal. In Athena, stroke goes down, in Pallas, stroke goes up. In Athena, cardiovascular death goes down, in Pallas, cardiovascular stroke goes up. So it's quite a reversal. Do we have an obvious explanation from looking at the data of either Pallas or Athena? And the answer is there's no pattern really jumps out. It's not, you might have expected, well, it's going to turn out to be the very high-risk patients in Pallas who suffered the hazard. Well, that's not true. The results are pretty consistent across most subgroups. And if you look back at Athena and say, well, maybe in Athena the really sick patients didn't do as well. Well, no, we don't see that. The results are highly consistent even in the sicker part of the Athena population, and some of these patients did have vascular burden. So no obvious explanation from the data. It's more, if you go back and say, well, how do these patient populations differ? There's two big differences. One is that the patients in the Pallas study had a much more significant burden of vascular disease. For example, about 75% of them had a history of heart failure in Pallas, whereas in Athena only about 25%. And other risk factors are similarly different. The other big difference, of course, is the difference between intermittent and permanent atrial fibrillation. All patients were intermittent going into the Athena study, and conversely, all patients were permanent in Pallas. That seems to be an important part of the explanation.
So, of course, with the results of Pallas, it's not surprising that the regulatory agencies are taking a fresh look at the ways in which we should use dronedarone. And we have already had some information from the European regulator. And as you might expect, we are no longer to use dronedarone in patients who have permanent atrial fibrillation. And they also identified heart failure as a particular problem. Can you tell us a little bit about the result from Pallas that stimulated the regulator to identify heart failure?
Well, of course, that is the fact that we saw an increase in heart failure hospitalization in the Pallas population. And we actually looked at other types of heart failure episodes that were not quite as severe, and they're also increased. So when you look at the totality of the heart failure information, there's a very clear signal for an increased risk with dronedarone compared to placebo in this population. When we ask the question, is it the patients with severe left ventricular dysfunction who had this problem? The answer is actually no. We see it fairly consistently across the board. No particular subgroup of patients seems to be more at risk. So we looked at patients with more advanced NYHA class compared to those with less advanced. That doesn't show us any sign. We looked at left ventricular hypertrophy. It actually seems to be somewhat protective. So there's no clear message. I would just point out that the heart failure in Pallas appears to be quite a lot of diastolic heart failure. I think it's around 25% had an ejection fraction below 40%. Yeah. So and with 60 or 70% of the patients, actually closer to 70%, having a history of heart failure, you realize that there was a lot of diastolic dysfunction, and left ventricular hypertrophy was rather common.
Jean-Yves, let me turn to you. The European regulator said no permanent atrial fibrillation, but of course the European Society of Cardiology guidelines had included dronedarone as a possible agent for rate control in permanent atrial fibrillation. I presume that's going to be removed at this stage.
Yes, of course it will be necessary to remove this point. I think to remove the possibility of using dronedarone as a rate control, as you said, and also the possibility to use dronedarone in patients with moderate heart failure, I mean class 1 or 2, it will be necessary to change this recommendation. Yeah.
So let's start thinking about some patients and how we might change our clinical approach to patients, or what kind of patients will now be appropriate for the use of dronedarone. Can I ask you, Jean-Yves, to tell us about a case that we can use to illustrate some of these issues?
Yes, I wanted to show you the story of one of my patients who was a former butcher living in Paris near the Eiffel Tower. He was 66 years old, and he came to see me for episodes of palpitation and chest pain at exercise, but not concomitant in different times. He had a history of hypertension treated by ramipril and dyslipidemia treated by pravastatin. He has never had any episode of heart failure. When I see him for the first time, as you can see, the electrocardiogram was in sinus rhythm. I ask him an echocardiogram showing a normal ejection fraction, and he made an Holter monitoring. That's the results of the Holter monitoring, and you see two periods of fast rate corresponding to atrial fibrillation. You have atrial fibrillation at the top and at the bottom, and in the middle, the patient is coming back to sinus rhythm. He also had a coronarography because of the chest pains, and as you can see, he has a stenosis, severe stenosis on the left anterior descending artery, and of course, he had an angioplasty and a stent. Times later, I had to choose what was the antiarrhythmic drug to give him, and as he was also a patient with coronary artery disease, I had chosen sotalol, and he received 80 milligrams sotalol BID. But as you can see, he had still recurrences and disabling recurrences. So my question was that I wanted to change the antiarrhythmic drug, and the question is it still possible with this new regulation about dronedarone, is it still possible to give him dronedarone? And my answer would be yes. As you said, John, we had proposed this algorithm for the choice of antiarrhythmic drugs in patients with underlying heart disease, and my patient is here in this place with coronary artery disease, and the proposal was dronedarone or sotalol, and it's still possible even with the new indication from the EMA, but it's clear that we have to be careful to be sure that he has a normal ejection fraction, and I said, Stuart, previously also that he had no history of heart failure, to think that perhaps it could have a diastolic dysfunction. And when we consider this algorithm, clearly it will be necessary to suppress this box. I mean that now with this new indication, it's no longer possible to prescribe dronedarone in these patients with class 1 or 2 heart failure, but it's not the case of my patient.
So you showed us a case that was clearly intermittent, relatively short paroxysms of atrial fibrillation, so it was not permanent atrial fibrillation, so theoretically dronedarone can still be used in a patient like that and is one of very few antiarrhythmic drugs that we have for those patients. But you also demonstrated that the patient had no history of heart failure and had a normal ejection fraction, again saying to us that this patient fits within the European regulations for the use of dronedarone. But the patient did have coronary artery disease, revascularized in this particular case, and such patients are still appropriate patients for dronedarone. Exactly. There are other patients, of course, those with minimal or no heart disease or with underlying hypertension that are also still appropriate for treatment with dronedarone. But this case, of course, has intermittent atrial fibrillation right now. But I think you were saying earlier, Stuart, that there tends to be a development, a progression of atrial fibrillation. So this case could, in another year or two, progress to a more persistent or even permanent atrial fibrillation. So let's assume for a moment that the patient comes back to see Jean-Yves, and now Jean-Yves, the patient is in atrial fibrillation and has been for 2 or 3 days. What would your first response be to that case?
We are coming to the case of these patients with, in fact, a persistent atrial fibrillation. It's not paroxysm, it's becoming persistent. If he has a persistence, the problem is to know if you want to cardiovert him or if you prefer to make a choice of rate control. Yes. That's the problem. If we speak about this patient, I think that I would choose rather a rhythm control because it's rather young, he's 60 years old, he has still an important physical activity, so I would propose him a cardioversion. But the question is, after the cardioversion, what will be the choice for the antiarrhythmic drug? I think that we are in the same case that what we do with the class 1 antiarrhythmic drugs. If we think that there is still a chance to maintain the sinus rhythm, perhaps we can try another time or to try to give him amiodarone. Or if I want really to maintain, there is also the possibility of ablation in this patient.
Saying that if you planned to do a cardioversion, you wouldn't keep him on dronedarone? I mean, it seems to me that if you're going to cardiovert this patient, it's reasonable to stay on dronedarone and see if it controls him. I mean, are you assuming that this is now a failure of dronedarone?
There is an important point, I think, is to know what is the circumstances of occurring of the relapse of atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. For example, if I think that the patient has relapsed because of a flu, because of sometimes a Saturday night atrial fibrillation with excess of alcohol consumption or something like that, my view will be different. Clearly, if there is absolutely no favoring factor, probably I would change and discuss with him the choice between amiodarone and ablation. Mm-hmm.
But I think, take this patient who's, let's say, tried dronedarone for 6-9 months, he's had no symptomatic recurrences, suddenly has this recurrence. I might well think, well, let's cardiovert the patient now and see if he maintains sinus rhythm, keeping him on the dronedarone. And I think that that would not be an unreasonable approach at this stage, rather than changing to a new antiarrhythmic. But I agree, there's a lot of differences between the way in which patients like this are handled. But let's say, Stuart, that this patient goes on in atrial fibrillation and he's not very symptomatic at all. And you see him now, let's say, a couple of months after going into atrial fibrillation. You know that he went into atrial fibrillation because he did go and see a doctor and it was diagnosed, but nothing was done about it. He's still on the dronedarone. What would you do now, 2 months down the line?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the typical situation is the patient comes back for routine follow-up, says he's feeling fine. I look at the ECG, and lo and behold, he's in atrial fibrillation with a controlled ventricular rate on his beta blocker and dronedarone. We don't know how long he's been in it, but one presumes it's probably been for quite some time. And, you know, that patient's now become permanent, and it's not infrequent that these patients do become permanent on dronedarone and perhaps another rate-controlling drug and don't have much symptoms, if any, right? Or sometimes they say, well, I had palpitations a few weeks ago when I was exercising or something. So it's pretty minimal.
You know, in that situation, you need to ask, well, how much do we want to maintain sinus rhythm? Or do we want to go the cardioversion route or try a drug or ablation? Those are all viable options, and a lot depends on the patient's own preferences as well. But in many situations, I would advise that patient to try rate control. And in that situation, even though it may appear that dronedarone has helped with the rate control and that it may be keeping this patient comfortable, I think we would definitely want to stop it and see whether we could get by without it.
You might have to provide a different form of rate control.
Possibly, yeah, possibly. I mean, I think one of the things that the Palace study has brought up for us, just to editorialize a little bit, is that we don't know that much about rate control. There have been almost no trials in permanent atrial fibrillation. The only one is quite a small trial with a somewhat inconclusive result, the RACE 2 study. Other than that, there's virtually no randomized trials focusing on this high-risk population and trying to understand what is the best treatment for them. We hypothesized that further rate slowing would be beneficial, and dronedarone certainly provides that. Was the rate slowing actually harmful? We don't know. One thing we do know is we need to learn more about permanent atrial fibrillation. Just as an aside, we see amiodarone used quite a lot for rate control, sometimes in Europe and in Latin America. I know it's used widely and also in North America. Should we be using amiodarone for rate control at all, considering that we know nothing about its benefits or harms in that setting?
It's often exactly the story that I've just developed with John Eve's patient taking dronedarone. Usually the patient's been taking amiodarone for rhythm control, and despite that, goes into permanent atrial fibrillation, and the physician leaves the patient on amiodarone simply because there's very good rate control.
And the patient feels well.
But we now know with dronedarone that that should not be the policy. We should take patients off it.
And I would actually question whether we should do it with any of the antiarrhythmic drugs, based on the results of PALLAS and the fact that these drugs have actions that are that we don't understand that well in this population.
We have one other group of patients, Jean-Yves, where we shouldn't be thinking of dronedarone nowadays, and it's patients with a history of heart failure, or actually with heart failure. The problem I have is the history of heart failure. Breathlessness or ankle edema can occur for other causes other than heart failure. Calcium antagonists causing the ankle edema, for example, COPD causing breathlessness. So how would you approach a patient with a history of suggestive of heart failure before deciding whether or not you should use dronedarone?
I would be very cautious with these patients, mainly because we don't know everything about that, as was saying Stuart. It's clear that some patients have heart failure at the time of the occurrence of atrial fibrillation, but that this heart failure is due only to the atrial fibrillation, and so-called tachycardiomyopathy, even if it's for a short period. So these patients after that will have absolutely no heart failure, neither systolic or diastolic. So it's clear that we are prone to give the drugs, saying if I avoid the episode of atrial fibrillation, I will avoid the episode of heart failure. In my mind, it could be logical, but to be cautious, I prefer to put that in my pocket, thinking that probably it's true. And when I see a patient for whom I can identify that he has or he had a history of heart failure, I prefer to be cautious and to avoid on it around.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with being cautious. I think we have to be cautious with the use of all antiarrhythmic drugs in general.
That's true for the other
ones. They all have difficulties. One thing that struck me would be if you have a patient where it's borderline, is it heart failure, not heart failure? It's always very helpful to look for objective evidence. So if there's no systolic dysfunction and no serious diastolic dysfunction, perhaps that's a way to be able to resolve the uncertainties. I don't know if that's really the right way to do it or whether we should be cautious.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. That's been a very interesting discussion. Of course, it's prompted by the results of the PALLAS trial reported here in Orlando at the American Heart Association. Unexpected findings, an increase in cardiovascular death, an increase in stroke, and an increase in hospitalizations for heart failure. This has caused repercussions at the regulatory level in Europe, and we're now not supposed to use dronedarone in patients with permanent atrial fibrillation and not supposed to use it in patients with heart failure or indeed a history of heart failure. We've been exploring cases of this kind this morning, and I think that we're beginning now to understand the true place of dronedarone. It's useful in patients with minimal or no heart disease, with or without hypertension, and it can still be used in patients with coronary artery disease. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity, Antiarrhythmics for Atrial Fibrillation, Practical Implications of the Latest Clinical Developments. To participate in the CME Activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.